Tonight on Arena, David Gray is back with a new album, Dear Life. Apple TV's Severance is back with a new season. And Video Nasty is a new Irish comedy. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena, or you can watch live on rte.ie/arena. It's TV review time tonight. Severance Season 2 has finally arrived on Apple TV Plus, almost 3 years after we were first introduced to the dystopian corporate world of Lumen Industries. Adam Scott is back as Mark S, as is his supervisor Seth Milchick. Trammell Tillman plays him. Hollywood A-lister John Turturro and Patricia Arquette and Christopher Walken return in Season 2, as does Ben Stiller, who once again dons the directorial hat for some of the episodes. Video Nasty is a dark coming-of-age comedy that was filmed entirely in Northern Ireland. It's set in 1985 when home video rentals were all the rage. The plot revolves around three teenagers who are on a quest to complete a cult VHS collection but end up becoming suspects in a murder investigation. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching and join me now in the studio. Before we went to air, Chris and Jen and I were having a bit of an argument. Is the problem with season two of anything Severance 2? We've asked Chris, you're going to give us a summary of season one, but going to be a little coy about some of, because if you give too much away and people want to start it from the beginning, it might be a bit difficult.
Yeah, it's also an unusual one with Severance because it's been 3 years since the first season aired. There's been all sorts of production delays. You had a writer strike, you had an actor strike. Just a long wait to see what happens next to Mark Scout, played by Adam Scott. A basic summary would be that Mark Scott, he lives in a world where, and he works for an industry where they offer their employers, Lumen Industries that is, this biotech company, the opportunity to be severed, to have a severed work existence. And what that is it's a chip that's inserted in the employee's head that separates their professional lives from their personal ones. It offers the employees this perfect work-life balance, or so they say. So when Mark goes in to work at Lumen Industries, he doesn't even know what exactly he's doing. He sits at a computer all day, surrounded by three other colleagues, played by John Turturro, Zach Sherry, and Brett Lower, and they are just they're scanning and inserting numbers into digital boxes. They don't really know what they're doing, collecting mumbo jumbo sort of data. They never really ask questions about what their outies do. This is the innies. This is their innie lives.
When they come in as outies, because they're coming from the outside, they go down in a lift to the Severance floor, and then they forget everything about their outside life.
Yeah, something switches in them. So as far as like the innies are concerned, this is the only place that they exist. What we learned about Mark in season one, without giving too much away, is that he's a widower. But when he's at Lumen Industries, he forgets the fact that, you know, he lost his wife in a car crash. But all sorts of things happened in the first season where these four employees in Mark's section, they decided to ask more questions about what kind of life they might be living outside, why they agreed to this sort of setup, why they agreed to this sort of life, and they kind of staged a little bit of an uprising. So the last time we saw them, again without giving too much away, they had found a technique, let's say, to remold, to put back together their innie and their outie lives, and they found out a little bit too much about the people they're working for.
And something within the innie lives, then close relationships had developed.
Yes, so you had a band of workers at first who became a band of close friends, but also Helly and Mark started to develop feelings for one another. But that's a little bit of a problem because on the outside, as I say, Mark is a widower. He learns that his wife might not actually be dead and that she might actually be working for Lumen. Again, a little bit cautious about giving too much away here, but the folks at Apple, they know that Severance has been such a long time coming, that not only for critics did they provide this, but for audiences this weekend, there's a 3-minute episode that you can watch which recaps everything. And also in the first episode of this new season, there's an entire animated sequence that Ben Stiller and Dan Erickson have put together that tells you everything you need to know.
And there was also a nice relationship between Irving, the John Turturro character.
Yes, so Irving, he is the John Turturro character, and he's been at Lumen longer than Mark. And in season one, he kind of, he looked up to the people that he worked for, despite the fact that he didn't know that much about them. But he also fell in love with one of the scientists, played by Christopher Walken. And something happens in season one where he's devastated to learn that, you know, he might not have his happy ending with Christopher Walken's character in the outside world, let's say.
Okay. All right. So we're set up now. I know what a ninny is. I know what a now she is. I know my four key characters. So what happens then in season two?
I mean, what happens in season two is like a Severance. For me, I'm a Severance skeptic. And I know that's horrible news to a lot of people out there. And feel free to delete me from your life. But I think, you know, for me, the problems with season one, like they've kind of been, it's kind of developed more for me in season two in a way. Like the first season for me, I thought it moved at this very glacial pace to get to its point. And then...
Yes,
like,
they weren't aware really of the problems when they were innies until quite late
yes,
in the series.
Yes, and there was a lot of repetition. There was a lot of the same point being repeated over and over again until I felt like I was one of those zombified innies. And I thought maybe that's another layer to watching the show. And I think that's... The final two episodes were something that were very special though, but I think it took too long to get to there. I think if season one had been six strong 40-minute episodes, it would have had a better impact because there is a lot of flab around this. And I do think it lacked that proper punch because you had to endure it. You had to endure, I think, the first four episodes really to get into it. And that, to me, is not a great show in that way because I think you should be able to get to your point quick enough. But I think, you know, sometimes with a concept like this, I think everybody took it to their hearts because this is like Marx's theory of alienation writ large. Like it appealed to so many viewers because it was saying something to them in this post-pandemic world about suffering under the weight of like late stage capitalism and the dominance of these multinational companies who are an anonymous faceless and giving their employees, you know, pizza parties. And that's not a solution to, you know, your stresses and your instability of your jobs. And it spoke to those very specific concerns. And I appreciate that and I appreciate its cleverness. I always think it looks amazing. There's been rumours that they're spending about, what, 20 million per episode, which Ben Stiller has denied. Mm-hmm. But it does, there is this kind of Kubrick...
But this season looks amazing.
It's
like
a Kubrick
there are washes
feel to it.
Of blue
yeah.
and then this dark white down in the Severance.
Exactly. And like that blinding area. White of that kind of Kubrick sensibility about modernity. And it, this mm-hmm. season, without... given too much away. It's
we
less
know that there has been a revolt.
Eruption, yes.
By these
now,
four.
Now, it's less about what we were looking at in the first season, as in the human risk, that kind of human endeavour. And it moves on to something that's kind of more philosophical, which I did find interesting. It's about the relationship now between, because they're aware of the outies. The innies are aware of the outies and that rivalry between them. And there is a deep, like, philosophical tension between the two halves of the self. So they're like, what do we owe each other? Am I one thing? Am I this thing? Who am I? Like, so it's getting into that kind of like, which is a lot richer. It's a lot deeper. And but I don't know if it will maybe appeal to the people that really enjoyed that skewering of the corporate culture and their working lives. I think with some of it, the characterization is my problem because I find Adam Scott's character, Marques, I didn't find him remotely like he behaves like a human in some circumstances. He's very blank. And I think the real person, the person that shines for me is Dylan, played by Zach Cherry. I think his story for the Audi in this season is really interesting and very moving and emotional. I think he's the emotional heart for me of it. It's a great performance.
Let's get back to what your thoughts are on season two, but let's play a clip from it. Here, Mark Scout, played by Adam Scott, meets his old supervisor. That's played by Seth Milchick, or Seth Milchick is his name. He's played by Trammell Tillman, who fills him in on what happened after Mark and his team escaped the building. This is after the revolt you talked about.
What you all did 5 months ago was one of the most painful moments in the history of this company.
5 months?
I too was wounded by it. But we must be cut to heal, mustn't we?
Wait, did you say your old office?
Mark, this is Miss Wong. Miss Wong, Marques.
Hello.
She'll be happy to mind your balloons while we chat. Right this way, Mark. You can shut it.
Is it normal for a child to...
Excuse the clutter.
So the new boss's assistant is a young Asian woman. So that is the child he's referring to. And Milchick there informs him that things are going to change. Do you, you're not a huge fan of Severance, are you either, Chris?
I like some things about it. I think the ideas are extraordinary. I think it works best as this sort of mischievous satire about, you know, just the troubling intricacies of everyday American office life, and also maybe office life all around the world, where, you know, you kind of give so much of yourself for such a little reward. I think it works best when Dan Erickson is exploring that, and he explored all of that in season one. But in season two, it's kind of, it's gone down a little bit too much into this puzzle box sci-fi territory where, you know, everything everybody says is a complete mystery. And the dialogue started to drive me mad a little bit, because I am invested in the story and I am invested in the visuals and the characters. Everyone actually, and I agree with Jen, except for maybe Adam Scott, I find them a bit too, there's not much to him. You know, I don't really know why we're invested in his character.
Is he supposed to be every man?
I think so. But I think, you know, I said this on this show 3 years ago, it's a wasted opportunity that Ben Stiller didn't cast himself in that role, because he is a stronger dramatic actor than people give him credit for. And I think he would have been able to handle, you know, the, because there is a little bit of dark humor in there. And I think he would have given a great performance, but also been funnier than Adam Scott.
Also, I think like Adam Scott is like moving from an everyman into some kind of superhero this season in a way which I didn't find that was believable for what the show should be. You know, I don't know what they're trying to do there when they're trying to push him forward. I think they should all be at a certain level, the same level, because they're all going through this together, you know, and it seems like he's almost one step ahead of everyone at every time.
That's why the Zach Cherry one comes in, the character comes into his own as villain, because he's more the everyman character.
He really is.
Like, well, we learned that like he has something on the outside. In season one, he actually thought that the world had ended. that, you know, he was down here maybe potentially counting bodies of those who survived, because again, they don't know what exactly they're working on. But when he discovers, and I won't give too much away, that he has something on the outside world to lose, that he has this, you know, rich, fulfilling life, he becomes a lot more interesting, because it's like, well, I want to get back to that. But with Adam Scott, like, there are scenes where he's running around the place like he's Tom Cruise, and he's got a great run, and those films, those scenes are very well shot. But again, he's not a superhero. He's supposed to be this ordinary guy who lost his wife and decided that for half the day or half the week, basically, he would like to forget about that. That idea was interesting. And again, I think the last time I likened this series to almost like Office Space, if it was directed by Charlie Kaufman and written by, or directed by Michelle Gondry and written by Charlie Kaufman.
Office Space was a show from
Office
the
Space
1990s.
Is a wonderful workplace satire by Mike Judge. Great film from the late 90s. And this kind of, you know, works with the same ideas but goes a completely different route with it. But this time around, there's a bit too much like Chris Nolan.
It's very ponderous, and I do think
I thought you said, Jen, that you liked that exploration.
I liked the exploration of where we're going with them as like splitting yourself into two, because I think it needs to go there, because I think that mystery of that is over from season one about the kind of the satire. Now it's into what do you do now? What happens now when you're aware, where you're conscious of the fact that this is happening and something is going on? How do you, you know, unite that in your mind? And what does that do to the self or the notion of the self? But I do think, like Chris was saying, the dialogue sometimes, there are pauses and gaps in conversation, or somebody will say something that's, you know, kind of mysterious. And that line delivery, there's this deliberate kind of emphasis on meaning, but I actually found it to be quite pretentious then. Yeah. I was like, I don't know if there is a deliberate meaning to a lot of these phrases that people are saying. And I think it's too slick for its own good sometimes. There is inherent blankness to it that kind of negates any kind of warmth, which is part of its tone and that's part of its appeal, but it doesn't really make for interesting characters sometimes, except for, I would say, the John Turturro's character, Irvin and Dylan, I think are the standouts for me because of that. Because of, like, I think with Dylan, with Zach Cherry's character, there is, outside of this, there are these small disappointments that you see that are like everyday life, and that brings you back to a reality that's within Severance, but it's hidden. It's very much hidden.
And Chris, season one, you know, where we got to understand the inner world. Now, are you more interested in being in the outside world with the outies? Yes. Yeah. And see what's happening there and what, well, if that's the real part of them, you would think that that's the real part of the person.
Again, we're kind of restricted about what we can say, but there is an episode coming up in season two which explores what happened in the minutes after season one ended, and that's all on the outside world. And anyone listening here who actually hasn't watched Severance, they're going to hear us talking about indies and outies, and they're going to think, what is this show about?
It's about belly buttons.
But it is an awful lot more interesting when you take the elevator back up to the outside world. I just wish that outside world resembled our world, because it's this problem again. If everything's weird, then that's just, it's too much.
There's no grounding.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to give us something that the characters want to get back to some sort of normality, but the world that they live in isn't normal. And that's just, it's disappointing.
Also, I think the darker implications of what they're doing are never fully explored for the other people outside of these four characters, maybe. And you get a glimpse of it kind of in season one, and then in season two, you kind of want a bit more of that. But I can understand they don't want to fall into Handmaid's Tale territory of like torture, you know, porn in that way. But I just think it's so coolly abstract sometimes that it does give you something to chew over. But for me, it just is flavourless then sometimes.
A stress out of 5 from you, Jen?
I'd give it 3.
3. And from you, Chris?
I think they've created a problem for themselves because they didn't anticipate it being so popular, and a third season's already in the works. So whatever sort of resolve they were working towards, that's been kicked up the field. So now we're going to draw out the mystery more than it needs to be, basically. So again, I like what's going on here. I like the actors and people behind it. 3 stars, but it's not as good as people say it is.
Can you remember what you gave us the last season 1?
Somewhere, it was probably 3. I can't imagine I gave it 4. Oh, okay. So I say 3 stars.
All right. Okay, so you're consistent.
Yeah, consistent.
Your feelings are consistent.
The innie is consistent.
So from futuristic America to Dublin in the 1980s, teenagers Billy and Con, Justin Daniels, Anine and Carl O'Driscoll have almost completed their collection of cult videos and need just one more VHS, and they can sell the collection and make enough money to pay off their debts, including the school debt they found borrowed from the borrowed money they borrowed from their schoolmates, and head to the UK to work in the movies. But things don't go according to plan. So Jen, tell us about the setup for this series.
Yeah, I mean,
it's on Virgin Media One, called Video Nasty.
The 80s really have like this vice-like grip on the consciousness of our current crop of TV and filmmakers, for sure. Like, the kids are growing up and they don't like the world that they've grown up into, so they want to retreat into that kind of safety of nostalgia of the past. So, you know, you have stuff like the revivals of Ghostbusters or The Karate Kid, and then of course like the runaway success of Stranger Things, and it just points to these ideas that analog was better, we had it better back in the day, and our innocence has been corrupted by the internet, which kind of sounds a bit like that fetishization or the cultural obsession that the filmmakers of the 80s had about the 1950s. So we're coming back around to those feelings again. But this is one of those things. It's like it's a love letter to like that time and that innocence, but those kind of forbidden films that just existed on video cassette and were passed around surreptitiously in schools. And, you know, Ireland was under the cosh of that kind of ultra conservative censors at the time. So you weren't seeing these titles like Driller Killer or The Last House on the Left. Like, they were all those kind of schlock
you
horror.
You could go to
shows.
Your VHS store, and some of those VHS stores would have something under the counter
exactly.
that would give you, which would be a
or
video.
Or pirated
nasty.
Copies from somewhere else that would mysteriously arrive, like. And so it's about that. It's about that kind of adolescent feeling of that thrill of, you know, doing something you're not supposed to be doing. So as you said, it's set in 1985, and these are like these two misfit teens, Billy and Con, and they are these little burgeoning film bros, and that appealed to me because I love that energy that they have. There is this great energy and connection between the two actors, and they are best friends in real life, I've heard. So, and when they were auditioning, they had to pretend not to be friends at all. So that was, you know, a good trick. And they convinced them, obviously. But so they're, you know, so invested in their future of those dreams of wanting to escape and wanting to be filmmakers. But they also have, you know, a tough kind of time in secondary school where it's a sports obsessed school, so they're being bullied severely for being nerds. Mm-hmm. And there's a nice gentleness of tone, and there's a real knockabout kind of zaniness to it that is, it zips along in that way. So it's very vibrant in that way.
And Chris, Billy is the one with the ideas. Con is just coming along because Billy is his mate, and that causes tension within the relationship.
It does, yeah. Con is kind of between Billy and Zoe, his sister. I mean, mean, like, despite the fact that Billy thinks that Zoe treats him like rubbish, like, Billy is always telling Colm what to do. But Billy's the one with this dream that let's collect all 72 films on the banned, you know, video nasty list. They have 71. And once we get to 72, we can then sell them to the highest bidder that a video shop owner named TJ, played by Kevin McGarren, will organize, and they'll make a bit of money for themselves. But in order to buy the videos, Billy has essentially bullied his best friend Colm into spending all of the Deb's money, because he's a school treasurer, on these films. And he's also set out this plan for him. You know, we're going to go to London next year and we're going to get jobs on film sets. But the series is, I mean, the series is obviously about these two boys trying to complete a collection and going to the UK and getting into all sorts of trouble. But it's also about two mates who might be reaching the end of this phase of their relationship, because Colm, he really doesn't have the heart and he doesn't want to let his friend down. He doesn't want to say to him, I don't share your dreams. I don't want to do that. And I mean, what friend hasn't been in that situation where you're planning out how you're going to be, you know, pals forever, but you want different things? So it explores that very, very well. Later on, we kind of get into some silly territory involving a murder investigation, which the boys and Zoe end up in the middle of. I think the performances are lovely. I think it's very, very lucky
they're
to have
two wonderful characters, aren't they?
Really are. And I think, like you're saying, like the Justin Daniels and Nene, who plays Billy, he's a one to watch. I think he's just, his performance is great. He's just this over enthusiastic, very determined kid who's, you know, desperate to escape his home life with his father, and he doesn't really relate to him, and he just wants to get away from those racist bullies that are in school every day and they torment him daily. And I think he has the best lines in the show. He's very charismatic. He's always undercutting like the really nervous Colm and pushing him into the great unknown, and he has this great presence about him, and I think he's very naturalistic. And I think, you know, he grounds it into being something believable, because it can kind of fly off the handle at times, as you said. Yeah. It's very escapade, like, driven. And
let's have a listen. Listen at the two of them here. This was early on in the first episode. Billy and Colm, Justin Daniels, Anine and Carlo Driscoll. They're checking out a video at a van on the side of the road with Christy, played by Rory Mullen.
Come on, lads. Hurry it up. Don't want to get raided.
I have to check the track.
It's a dragon. If you don't want it, go watch fucking Ghostbusters, yeah?
Relax, Christy, will you?
Give us a minute.
Is it real?
Yeah. It's genuine. First generation. Look, this is the last of the money, all right? Don't throw it away. Just stick to the plan, follow my lead, and don't show any weakness, yeah?
Yeah.
Not a penny over 25. Let's go.
The best we can do is 20. All right, that's all we have.
You're fucking joking. I'm taking all the risks here. The distributor of that film, he's in prison. You know that, lads?
Okay, then 30, all right? But no more.
It's number 71. It's worth it.
Ah, 71. You've nearly got the full Video Nasty collection. And you need this one. 40, or I walk.
Colm making a mess of that big deal there. Sorry about the bad language there. So, stars out of 5 for Video Nasty on Virgin Media.
I think we were talking about this beforehand. I wish a little bit more effort had gone into actually making the characters look and sound as if they're in the 1980s. It can be a little bit too modern at times. But I quite like this. I like the tone of it. There's a lightness about it. The two lads, as we say, are great together. So, 3 stars. And also, can someone hurry up and make a comedy drama in Ireland set entirely in an old school video shop, because the scenes in the video shop are great. I watched a whole show about that.
It's like Moon Boy style, or like mixed with, they like wanted to be a little bit like Spaced. I just wish the story was tighter, and as Chris was saying, those little clunkers in the dialogue that you don't hear 80s kids saying, we would never have said spoiler alert or anything like that, and that attention to detail needed to be there for something that's set in like the past in that way. But I do think it's got a lot of heart and it's got loads of gumption, and as I said, great performances. So
stars out of 5. 3. Okay, so Severance Season 2 is on Apple TV and Video Nasty is on Virgin Media 1. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you. Now it's time for our album reviews. David Gray returns with Dear Life, his 13th studio album following a reflective period touring to mark the 20th anniversary of White Ladder, a record that is still the best-selling album of all time in Ireland. London-based Sophie Jemison's second album, I Still Want to Share, delves into themes of love and self-discovery shaped by her personal journey and struggles with alcohol. And finally, from the streets of Walthamstow, I knew I wouldn't be able to pronounce that, in London, emerges Rose Grey, delivering louder pleas, a ode to London's nightlife and the euphoria found within it. I'm delighted to be joined by Cian Sullivan and Nadine O'Regan, who have been listening to all three albums, but let us start with David Gray and the track Plus and Minus, featuring Teeliel Ray.
Can't have turning love's picture to the wall. Next moment there's no turning back. The following report may contain scenes that some might find upsetting. Look at me, read what's written here. This whole routine is getting old.
It's getting old.
You know the way the light is always painting someone else's windows go. Stops you cold. Remind me why we're doing this. You know it's silly, but I keep forgetting. Darling, from where I'm sitting, hey, this whole routine is getting old. It's getting old. So for the fire that gets lit, ooh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for the flame that
as you are in plus and minus, sailing by like ocean liners.
That's Plus and Minus there from David Gray's new album, Dear Life. And as I said, I'm here with Cian Sullivan and Nadine O'Regan. Cian, as we said, he revisited White Ladder on the tour to mark its 20th anniversary. Can you see influences in Dear Life from that, from White Ladder?
I think you definitely can. You know, he said that when he was on the 20th anniversary tour, he said that revisiting those songs was a reminder of the classic songcraft and the electronic undercurrent that made them so memorable. And I think, you know, I think he's at this stage where he's kind of not afraid to push himself, which I think is great. And I think he was kind of just surrounded by some of the more popular sounds of that album that have really kind of gone on to influence this album.
Now, Nadine, it brought you back in time.
Oh, it did. Yeah, I mean, I think I first saw David Gray when I was 17 back in Connolly's of Leith. And he was somebody who made a huge impression on me to the extent that when he finished the gig, I actually asked him to sign the only thing I had on me at the time, which was my Debs photos. I had printed out my Debs photos. So I have one of the Debs photographs. The back of it says David Gray, very randomly. I followed his career over the years. The first three albums I particularly loved. Funnily enough, it took me a while to warm to White Ladder because it was such a change from where he had been, from the sort of acoustic-led, the folk rock, the Bob Dylan influences. This edition of electronica felt so alien that I remember feeling extremely uncomfortable with it at first, and it took a while for me to really love it. But now, you know, you think back to the fact that the likes of Ed Sheeran and so many others have really adopted that style. And on this particular record, I think it is fair to say that he brings back some of the sort of syncopated beats and flourishes, electronic flourishes that did characterise White Ladder. Personally though, for me, the album really makes more of an impact in the second half, where it's a little bit quieter. There's more almost like a Sigur Rós kind of feel, where there's these very beautiful sort of early morning type songs. And, you know, David Gray has a very natural kind of mournful, reflective, nostalgic lilt to his vocal. And I think it plays very well in that part of the album.
There are a variety of themes explored here, Cian, aren't there?
Yeah, it sounds like he hasn't had the best few years, but by what's been going on, you know, he's reflecting on his own mortality. I think that track that we played there seems to be him trying to fruitlessly fix this failing relationship. There's kind of explorations of after the end of a relationship and just sort of being kind of left with the what now. He seems to have kind of just a lot of ruminations on, you know, where he is in his life, where he is in his relationships, but he seems to kind of reckon all of it with a smile on his face. I think there's a lot of hope in this. I think there's a lot more kind of roundedness to the beats in this that I think is quite uplifting. And I think, you know, compared to his previous album, Skellig, which I think is using silence as an instrument, I think he's very much happy to kind of create a momentum in these songs because he's keeping pushing on through all the hardship.
Nadine, were you familiar with the Skellig, which was inspired obviously by Skellig here in Ireland?
Yeah, and you know, I interviewed him on that album, and it was just fascinating to hear how he'd come on this journey where he really wanted to. I think he'd sort of reconciled himself with his past, because I think it is genuinely very difficult to be David Gray in a way, to have this enormous success hanging over your every move, and in some ways, perhaps people view him as yesterday's man, not because he's not an excellent songwriter, because he is an excellent songwriter, but because of this album that sits in everybody's household. So when he emerges with an album like Skellig, or indeed with this 13th record, it's always getting compared with the great, enormous hit of the past. But I think one of the things that's very important is, you know, he's still playing these huge gigs. He's playing the Three Arena coming up this year. He'll have gigs in Limerick. And you think to yourself, you know, he still makes music that people consistently want to listen to, and he's a great performer. The head nodding, I'm sure many people like the current single, Plus and Minus, it's one of the ones where you can feel yourself doing the head nod that he became so famous for on stage. And you know, this album for me, it's a little bit polite, it's a little bit sedate in parts, and there are times when it's overly commercial for my taste, and I wish he had the anger that he used to have on the first three records, particularly on Sell, Sell, Sell. But there's some lovely stuff here regardless.
What do you think, Cian?
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed it. I thought, you know, considering, and I know that Nadine hinted that at, you know, inspiring people like Ed Sheeran or James Blunt, for example, who I know kind of got tied up with in the past, being compared to. I hear Dermot Kennedy in this. I hear all of these people in there, and I think he's kind of back to show, you know, that he can still do his thing in the vein that inspired all those people just as successfully as he has, whatever, 20 years ago. I quite liked the kind of more adult contemporary sound to it. I was pleasantly surprised, but there's also some...
Is that middle of the road by a different adult contemporary?
No, but like...
I think so.
That's very polite.
But I think there's also some more experimental sounds in here. Like, I really enjoyed Leave Talking, that had these like big, brash, dissonant horns. It's almost a 7 minute long track where it's where the album gets its name, where he's kind of building in angst as the song goes on. He's like clinging on to what was never his. He's kind of, you know, not screaming, but like you can feel the anguish coming out of him, I think. And I think some of those tracks were kind of distinct amongst the kind of, I would say, slightly too long track list.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Cian, for David Gray.
I think people who may not have kept up with his career might enjoy going back to this one. So I give it 4 stars.
4 stars from you. And from you, Nadine?
3.5.
So very positive for Dear Life from David Gray. Next up is I Still Want to Share from Sophie Jemison. Relationships are the focus of the Londoner's second album following the much praised Choosing. Let's hear a track you both chose, I think, to highlight. I Don't Know What to Save.
I don't wanna push you away, but distance speaks in volumes, and I'm only just okay. Build me something better now. Tell you that we're not the same, but I'm hanging on the weather that surrounds you all damn day, picking up whatever you make and glue it back together when it breaks. Will you build me something better?
I Don't Know What to Save there from I Still Want to Share by Sophie Jemison. I think you really like the album title, Nadine.
Yeah, the album title I Still Want to Share. It just, for me, it sums up, now I'm not saying this is exactly what she meant by it, but for me it sums up how many artists approach recording these days, which is they're releasing their albums onto Spotify, they're making very little money, they often pay for their own tours, you know, and in a way the work has to be its own reward, the creativity has to be its own reward. And she is releasing her second album, and this line, I Still Want to Share, it almost suggests, here I am, a London-based singer-songwriter who may not be very well known to many people, who may not have had enormous success with the first album, commercially at least, but I still want to give of myself. I want these songs to be shared, and I want the creativity to be recognised, even if it's only in the act of releasing it into the world.
They're very descriptive songs, Cian, aren't they? There was a great sense of movement in tracks like Vista and Highway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I think you alluded to it at the start there. So her first album was kind of all about her relationship to alcohol. This is now her relationship with love, and kind of a conflict between love and then attachment, you know, of this relationship. And it's told kind of throughout the album. But I really enjoyed Vista is this fly on the wall account of a couple who are on this kind of road trip holiday, and they just begin to sort of fight, and the fight escalates as the song goes on. And you can see her kind of go back to the pub, basically, to ease the pain. She's throwing all the money to the drink. So you can kind of see that as a link to the first album. And similarly, you know, all throughout the album, there's this great sort of sense of moodiness we heard in that track there. It's really cinematic. It's really kind of sheer and scary. Her voice, I found really, really compelling. I think it's her, by far her best instrument. It has kind of the mournful breathiness of like a Kate Le Bon. At times, I was like, that's Adele. There was a really warm crooningness to it as well. And then at times, she has this real like vulnerable warble that was kind of reminding me of Björk. So there's a lot going on in her voice, and she could really tell a tale with it.
Yes, her voice is, I thought, How Do You Want to Be Loved? I thought her voice was extraordinary on that one. Nadine.
Yeah, I mean, the vocal, the way it's produced as well is quite interesting. She's learned some very good production tricks along with her collaborators, and actually,
we heard beautiful production about the music building as the song
went on. Yeah, and there's a kind of a percussive quality in everything she does. She's worked with Grammy Award winning Guy Massey, who himself has worked with Spiritualized, and I think that Spiritualized reference is interesting there. And also, you know, if you think about her own influences, Laura Marling, Elena Tonner from Daughter. I found myself thinking of artists like Bonnie Prince Billy as well, and Anna Calvi. And so there's that moodiness, the bluesiness. I mean, I'll be honest, this album for me is a little bit too spare, too sparse. I recognise her talent, and at the same time, I found it difficult to sort of grab hold of, in the sense of, you know, where are the tracks that I would absolutely return to. I think sometimes you can really respect an album and respect the endeavour while at the same time saying this isn't exactly the sonic palette that I particularly would go for, and I found that with this record, but that isn't to take anything from the talent.
Yeah, Cian, I think you were thinking of David Gray's Skellig, because you said to listen to this by Sophie you should go to the west of Ireland and take it all in.
I said, if you've just been broken up with, and head off to a house in the west of Ireland and put this song on and cry your little heart out, because I think that is the perfect setting for this album. And unfortunately, like Nadine was saying, if you're not in that mindset, I think it might be harder to access.
Right. Stars out of five from you, Cian.
Yeah, look, like I said, I think, you know, if you get it in the right spot, it could be amazing. But until then, I think it's about a 3-star.
3-star. And from you, Nadine?
A 3.
Okay, and that's for Sophie Jemison, I Still Want to Share. And finally, music from another Londoner, this time it's Rose Grey, making her debut with her dance pop album, Louder Please. This is a tribute to the nightlife of her city and to her dance pop heroes. No surprise then, the hedonism and strong presence on the album. Let's take a minute off the track, Wet and Wild.
Dress you never see. My mascara runs, but it's just the rain. I won't shed a tear. Like to make you rain. Two in the morning, I don't need all the
That's Wet and Wild from Louder Please by Rose Gray. Cian, Nadine was talking there about Sophie Jemison and that whole thing of young singer-songwriters having to not only write their album, bring it out, then tour it, all on their own back, really, all on their own money. And then we have Rose Gray, and she's in the cauldron of dance music with so much competition.
Yeah, she is. And she's taken her time as well to kind of break through. She quit college to become a pop star. She started making music in a more of a kind of a soulful tradition, I think something that you'd more hear in like Notting Hill Carnival rather than, you know, in the nightclubs, kind of more soulful, kind of more dub, kind of reggae in there. I actually found at that time her voice really sounded like the pop singer Anne Marie. I think she's moved a bit away from that now. She's since 2022 and her EP Synchronicity, she's been doing sort of dance collaborations with Kungs. She's got a shout out by Elton John on his Rocket Hour Apple Music radio show, and she's very much embraced, yeah, the dance pop space and is, yeah, trying to make a big from that.
An Irish connections is it with Big Pig?
Yeah, yes, exactly. So I last time I was on the show, I was shouting out a tip for 2025, the new album by Big Pig, which I'm very excited for. And I heard actually a lot of that in this. And then I read that that Rose Gray is a big fan of that. So I think you can definitely hear that on that. She also worked with the Galway-born Sega Bodega, who's worked with a lot of the kind of dance music from London at the moment as well.
So Nadine, Justin Tranter then is the writer on this. So what kind of material is she working with from him?
So they're co-writing the album, and he's worked with Chaperone, Lady Gaga, and it's really interesting, this record, because you can feel her fingerprints across every bit of the record. You know, I do think, like Charlie XCX, she has a lot of talent in the writing space, and it's clear that this is the product of a lot of hard work on her part. It isn't just like, you know, a bunch of writers creating stuff for her to put out, because I actually think she's fighting quite hard to be heard, in the sense that, like, really for this type of music to succeed, it needs massive backing. You know, you think of who is going to win in this space. It's Dua Lipa, it's Kylie. And actually there's a couple of songs here that I really found myself thinking, if Kylie had taken the song Angel of Satisfaction, I think Kylie could have made it a really big hit. Or equally, if Rose Gray had gone to the Eurovision with it, I think it could be a really big hit. But the problem is, in this space, you don't just sell your music, you sell the video, you sell the Instagram. You know, you have to achieve this kind of charismatic space around you where people are going, okay, I'm going to buy into the whole shtick, you know, the look, everything. I mean, one thing she does have going for at the moment, which is a total side point,
but a bit of gossip.
I'm just going to say it anyway. Her boyfriend is Harris Dickinson. He of Baby Girl, who's, you know, such a big presence at the moment in the cinemas with Nicole Kidman.
This was the film with Nicole Kidman.
And they are childhood sweethearts, and he's directed some of her videos. And it's quite clear that they have a creative, collaborative spark, as well as a romantic spark. And I think that they're becoming a bit of a kind of an it couple at the moment in the London scene. And, you know, it is possible that she will emerge records away from this record as that kind of Charlie XCX person who becomes enormous five albums in. But at the moment, these are good songs, but there isn't a total banger on it to lift this record into the extraordinary.
No bangers, Cian.
Look, do I think Wet and Wild's a banger? Yes, but I think I agree with what Nadine is getting at. This is such a crowded space between the people you mentioned, you know, and the legacy acts of Kylie and Girl Rap, who we all love. Then you've got Shy Girl, who's doing her own thing in the club. You've got Jade from Little Mix, who's breaking out in her own sort of club scene. What I found with Rose Gray, unfortunately, is that I found this quite anonymous, and I really was rooting for this album. I really wanted it to be maybe a bit better. I think there's a lot of promise here. I really look forward to hoping that she gets the opportunity to grow. But I think at the moment, this beer is slightly on the anonymous side.
Okay, that's a bit sad for Rose. Cian, how many stars out of five from you?
Yeah, look, I will definitely listen to this again. But for her trying to do what she's trying to do, people have done it a lot better. So it's 3.
And from you, Nadine?
I genuinely, like, you know, think she's got something, but she may wind up being a writer for other people and a brilliant writer. So I'm going to say 3.5 because it's just not quite there. But she has a lot of potential.
Cian Sullivan and Nadine O'Regan, thank you so much. Rose Gray's album is Louder Please. Sophie Jemison's is I Still Want to Share. And David Gray's is Dear Life. That's it from Arena for this week. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And the show was produced by Sinead Egan. Remember Tradfest on Monday and Tuesday. Either listen here on Radio 1 or see you at Dublin Castle. And Fiacna O'Brien on is next.